my sincere hope that wherever and however you celebrate this thing, and that you receive all that it is that you want. This is Easy Weave. My name is Easy Weave. This is Easy Does It on Dogs by Nature. And Merry Christmas. It's a wonderful time to be speaking with you. I guess any time is a wonderful time to be speaking with you. It's an even more wonderful time when it's not only this time of year, but a time where our beloved Roarange Helmets, the Cleveland Browns, are getting prepared to finish off a season that is going to go down as the best that we've had in a while. And it's not just enough to say that it's the best that we've had since 2014, or if we win 8 games, it'd be 2007. This is the best season from a real standpoint. You know what I mean? Because, like, 2007, even 2002, when we went to the playoffs, and certainly 2014, really weren't real successful seasons in the sense that it wasn't real what we were watching. All three of those incidences turned into aberrations, because in 2002 we went to the playoffs. The next year we go 5-11. The year after that is when it all went wrong. Butch quit, and then it went on down the road. 2007, we should have made the playoffs, didn't. And the following year we kind of really shoot for the moon to bring in a bunch of guys, and it doesn't work out. We go 4-12 that year, fire everybody, and that begins the chain of events that led to the before everything, the 2014 season, where we start off 7-4, and people were legitimately talking about playoff aspirations and Brian Hoyer signing a long-term contract extension and so on. And of course, we lose the final 5 games of that year and route to the worst stretch of football in the history of professional sport, which is immediately following. In 2015, we went 3-13, and you know the whole story. So we're not there anymore. We're at a part where right now 6-7-1, and we are legitimately looking like a team that is on the ascendancy. There are actual pieces in place at the most important positions on this team that, now, not all the way there, certainly. And of course, what the linchpin of all of this is the ascendancy of rookie hotshot quarterback Baker Mayfield, number 6 in the program, number 1 in your hearts. He had some really interesting things to say this week. Basically, if you're not about winning these last 2 games, then you can just get off the team. You don't need to be on the team. I really, really love that this guy has the sort of moxie as a rookie to talk about the way that members of his team ought to be conducting themselves, because he is the leader of this team. He is the undisputed leader of this football team. And the only chance that it has to succeed this year and beyond is with him at the helm being awesome as he has been. And we need only go back to the beginning of this year before he took over, and the stretches of time where Hugh Jackson and Todd Haley, the former erstwhile head coach and offensive coordinator, were kind of strapping him down with kind of limiting artificially what he was able to do. Outside of that, the guy has been the reason why we've had a chance to compete in any of these games and win any of these games. So he is the leader of this team, and it's great to watch him, kind of take over that leadership role. And I completely 100% agree with him. These last 2 games, you're going against the Cincinnati Bengals and the Baltimore Ravens. If you can't get up for those games, then I don't want you on the team either. And there was something that Michael Irvin said one time about I've talked about this before because it really struck me. And this was back during, I think, the Chud days. Because, Michael Irvin went to he went to college with Rob Chudzinski. And they, at the University of Miami. And so he was very high on Chud being a coach of us. So he was talking about how the Cowboys were, when they came into the league, when he came into the league, the Cowboys went 1-15. He's like, when I came into the NFL, and all my years, playing in high school, playing in college, I made a bunch of plays and we won a bunch of games. I get into the league and, first game, we go down the field and the guy, throws me a touchdown and I score, and I'm thinking, okay, this is how football is. He says, and then, proceeded to watch, the other team go down and score and then score again and then score again and score again. And of course, those Cowboys didn't keep pace, and they lost 15 games that year, and it crushed him. It crushed Michael Irvin that they were basically doormats. But what was worse was that there were veteran players that were on that team that went up to him because they could see that he was visibly, you know, unnerved by the experience of you know, being on a loser. And they're like, hey, don't worry about it, kid. Don't worry about it. You know, this isn't a big deal. You know, basically, you know, just it's how it is in the big leagues. You know, you win some, you lose some, and you lose some, you know, you lose some, and, you know, don't worry about it. Basically, they didn't care. And Irvin was deeply offended that there was players on his team that didn't seem to care when he deeply, passionately cared about the success of his team. And when the new coaching staff took over, of course, that was Jimmy Johnson, he was not shy about going to the new staff and saying, these are the guys that you need to get off of this team because these are the guys that are the cancer. And they summarily did, not, you know, just because of Urban's recommendation, but they did end up getting rid of those guys. Those guys were among the first to go, and they brought in a new, you know, stable of characters. And that Cowboys team went from 1-15 to 2 years later being in a playoffs, and 3 years after, you know, 3 years after the bad 1-15 season, they were winning. They were on the cusp of their dynasty run of winning three championships in 4 years, and it just goes to show you what. Now, of course, there was a huge influx of talent that was on that roster, but there was also a massive, massive adjustment in the focus of the players that were on that team. By the time the Cowboys won that first Super Bowl, they had a whole team full of Michael Irvins from the standpoint of guys that care deeply about the Cowboys' success or failure. Well, it may be that when Baker Mayfield, you know, stepped onto the field, when he strode onto the, you know, into the huddle and took over for this team, that maybe. And he said this, you know, recently that, you know, I don't know what it was like here, you know, all the losing that's gone. I don't ever want to know what it was like to go through all of that. I know that the fans have gone through it, and I want to, you know, change all that. I want to turn all that around. You know, losing matters to Baker Mayfield, and not caring about losing and not caring about getting up for a division rival like the Cincinnati Bengals, you know, that's intolerable to him. And I love that because that he, because he's the leader of the team and he sets the example. He sets it with his work ethic. He sets it with his performance and he sets it with, you know, his attitude and he doesn't hold back. It's funny. I was just reading a quote from Joel Bitonio who was talking about, how when he first came in against the Jets, he said there was some linebacker came through on a blitz and hit him or something, and the linebacker is jawing at him, and Baker is jawing right back at him like, I don't even know your name. I don't even know. He's like, and Bitonio in his head is like, Baker, dude, you've got like seven NFL plays under your belt and you're jawboning this guy. But that was the point. This kid came out the gate ready to go. It didn't matter to him that he had only played in the NFL seven plays. He knew that he was the best player on the field, and he was going to make sure that the other team knew that, and he then went out and proceeded to prove it. And that sort of edge, that sort of moxie, that sort of chip on the shoulder, it's the thing about this guy that when I was going through all of the, you know, postseason machinations, the whole draft process, and everything that, you know, we go through this every year. We look at all the positions, and until we had a quarterback, we would look at all the quarterbacks. I spent, you know, really last year, I spent a lot of time looking at just the quarterbacks. I looked at the other positions too, but admittedly, I didn't spend anywhere near as much time on the other position groups as I did quarterback, because to me, nothing else mattered. And Mayfield, right away, jumped out. I've told this story before, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself on this for those of you that already know. But, you know, there's new listeners. I know this from the totals that I see, but also, you know, new platform and so on. And when this whole process began, you know, in earnest, so when the Browns were like kind of officially eliminated from any sort of not just playoff contention, but any sense that they would have a decent year in 2017. So we're talking maybe like week three or four. It was when it was time to start looking at the draft. And the first guy that I looked at, the first really quarterback that I was even familiar with of the class, I mean, I knew the names, but as far as, it's one thing to kind of passively watch college football, and it's another thing to scout players. And so passively watching football, I was, you know, more familiar with Lamar Jackson than really any of them. Not that I hadn't, you know, like I said, not that I wasn't familiar with Rosen and Darnold, and I knew who even Josh Allen was. I had, you know, we'd kind of begun that process the year before. But Lamb Jackson, he was the first one that I looked at. And so I put on the tape, and what I saw was, wow, dynamic athlete that has really underrated, extremely underrated from the pocket passing ability. And it didn't take me very long to kind of come to the conclusion, this guy's going to be the first pick in the draft. He's got, you know, all the skill in the world. And I then began to, you know, set about making my case. Now, admittedly, I hadn't watched anybody else, but I remember going on the Chow the next day and be like, man, I'm looking at this guy Lamar, and nobody's really talking about this guy. But, you know, I started, you know, saying, I think that he may actually be the guy. And it was Bizono, who doesn't frequent as much as he used to, but he kind of electronically tapped me on the shoulders, like, hey, easy. Because he knows me. I'll get off on, you know, I'll go flying off all half-cocked. And he's like, you know, before you do that, before you pronounce any sort of judgment here, take a look at this Mayfield kid. I was like, okay, cool. You know, I was going to do it anyway, but upon his suggestion, Baker was the next guy that I watched. So, and look, I knew the same thing that everybody else did. Air raid offense, gotten, you know, trouble with the cops that one time, seems to be cocky and arrogant, short by, you know, conventional NFL standards, and the rote comparisons, you know, fair or unfair, and of course it turned out to be not, you know, not just unfair, but stupid comparisons to Johnny Manziel. And so that was the background that I had. I hadn't really watched him. I think that I had watched the OSU game from the year before. And if you recall, the not the senior year when he went in and planted the flag. I was actually working that night. I saw the plant flag thing, which I thought was funny at the time and afterward. But I'm saying the previous year when they played up in Norman and the Buckeyes went in there and whooped them pretty good. So all I'm saying is that I really didn't have a whole lot of background. I put the tape on and it was within 30 seconds. And this, by the way, the first game that I watched was the Sugar Bowl against Auburn. And the first throw, or not the first throw, but within 30 seconds, I see my first wow throw. And it wasn't a, you know, it wasn't like a Patrick Mahomes, or although he had a lot of wow throws that weren't necessarily all about arm strength, or Josh Allen, where it's like you see the ball fly off the arm. You're like, whoa, that guy can really sling it. This was one of these passes that was like, you know, over top of the linebacker, but in front of the safety, dropped in the bucket for a guy running directly in stride on a, you know, play where he kind of manipulated the coverage and moved around in the pocket. Did like four or five NFL quarterback things on one play where I'm like, whoa, you know, that is like, I got to watch more. And so I proceeded to watch the rest of the game, and I kept seeing those traits over and over and over and over and over and over again. So I started watching more games, and it didn't take long before I was like, okay, I like Lamar Jackson, but Baker Mayfield is absolutely the guy. And, you know, within the – and actually at that point, I'm like, you know, if the improvement I see from Jackson to Baker, you know, transfers over to Darnold and Rosen and Allen, then this is going to be a fun quarterback watching year. And it was. I mean, I watched all those guys. Watched Allen, watched Rosen, watched Darnold. And it didn't take me very much time to realize that, yeah, these guys are pretty good. They've got a lot of traits, but they're not Baker Mayfield. And then I went back and watched more Mayfield, and then watched more Mayfield, and watched more Mayfield, and I was hooked. So all that to say, the physical traits, the talent, the, you know, and the stuff that you look at that you look for in a quarterback, an NFL-ready quarterback, a guy that can perform at the pro level, all that stuff Baker had in SCADS. And that was all fine and good and impressive and whatnot. But it was when I really started to learn more about the man, learn more about who he was. And, you know, like I remember, for example, the thing, like I mentioned, the crotch grab thing against Kansas. And all I remember is everybody being all hot and bothered because he had done the thing where he was on the sideline grabbing his crotch and yelling F you to the opposing team. That's all that anybody saw. So then I, you know, do what I do. I'm like, well, what was that actually all about? Okay, so then I find out that the reason that he was all irritated with them had to do with, it started with a pregame snubbing of the handshake. So I'm like, okay. So they went to go out to, you know, the teams go out to midfield before the game to shake hands, and the Kansas players wouldn't shake his hand. And I'm like, well, why? I mean, it was before even moving off that point, I'm like, well, why didn't they shake his hand? You know, what did he do? Did he, like, because I heard that he had, you know, was certainly fairly prolific in social media and so on. And come to find out that, well, really all that it was they were trying to get in his head. They were just trying to, okay, so you're trying to get in this guy's head So then what does he do? He proceeds to go out there and toss up 27 points in the first half against his team. So you got in his head, and all it did was fire him up. And then there was a cheap shot taken, you know, at the after. So they try to rattle him. He proceeds to go out and stomp their face off, and then they try to take a cheap shot at him. And that's what proceeds. So when I realize the context of it all, I'm like, well, not only do I not have a problem with this, but I'm absolutely 100% on his side. And that was without really any sort of bias as far as, you know, him. You know, in other words, I wasn't trying to talk myself into him being our guy and thus, you know, talking myself or anybody else out of any shortcomings he may have. It was just as an objective, standalone thing. Because honestly, at that point, when I see the tape, there is a little bit of this. There's something wrong here. This is too good to be true. Because if it actually is as good as it looks, then more people would be about this guy, and less people would be doing the Manziel comparison. So there's got to be something. So it then, which is also, by the way, why I can certainly understand why a lot of people didn't see it coming with his, you know, unbelievable pro performance to this point. Truly unbelievable performance to this point. I can understand it because of, like I say, all these factors. All you know is kind of what you see peripherally. And then when what you do see is just off the charts before you, there's got to be something else. Well, okay, so as a standalone, as I'm watching this, and I'm really trying to seek, is this guy going to be a problem? Is this guy actually a cancer? That incident, I'm like, okay, no. Like, based on what I know from this situation, that ain't it. And in fact, that's kind of exactly the type of guy that we need in Cleveland. Like, when I saw that, you know what I saw? I saw a guy that refused to be a doormat. I saw a guy that refused to allow himself or his team to be intimidated or, you know, relegated to secondary status within the context of the football game. And he fought back, and he fought, and by the way, I then started to, you know, hear about all of his teammates and the way that they thought about him. And all that you ever heard from any of his teammates is nothing but unconditional, universal love and affection and adoration. Like, you don't hear people talking about other members of their team. So, okay, there's the other incidents, and you go through the whole thing. As the draft season started to unfold, you've got the deal with his mom being sick, and so he goes to the Senior Bowl and basically takes over that whole thing. What started to emerge was a picture of a guy that not only had this unique physical ability and this you know, what seemed to be like really next-level NFL quarterback talent, also had a mindset that was very unique in its own right and very much different from the other guys that I was really looking at and examining. And then you get into the whole aspect of, you know, when I really learned and thought about and contemplated what it meant to be not just the first walk-on to ever win the Heisman, but I think that the other first was important. The fact that he was the first true freshman to walk on and start an FBS opener. And I'm thinking to myself, what is that, you know, how does that come to be? He, you know, is overlooked. Obviously, he had the talent to go in there and play for a major program like Texas Tech and win the starting job and play very well his freshman year. And then inexplicably, they don't offer him a scholarship, although they had this guy, Patrick Mahomes, who was coming up. So it ended up working out for them, although Mahomes didn't do near as well in his career as Mayfield would end up doing is in his. But you're talking about a guy that then transferred because he didn't get a scholarship and walks on to Oklahoma, where he walks up to Bob Stoops and says, hey, how you doing? I'm Baker Mayfield. I'm your starting quarterback. Who does that? This kid does that. And then he went out and proved it by putting together at least two of the top three, probably, you know, quarterback seasons in NCAA history, his performance is at Oklahoma. So there's what that demonstrated to me was a mental toughness. By the time we got around to the Rose Bowl, I was very curious to see how he was going to hold up against a very tough Georgia defense. And what I saw was a guy that not only did he not hold back, he went out attacking that Georgia defense. And they ended up, as an offense, putting up 41 points against that Bulldog defense. Unfortunately for them, for the Sooners, and for me that night, because I was kind of pulling for them, because what I wanted to see was the validation. Everything everything that I had seen on the tape was telling my eyes that this was the guy. But what I needed to see was, can this guy rise to the challenge in big games? And he absolutely did. It wasn't his fault that the Oklahoma defense couldn't stop the Bulldogs from rushing for 45,000 yards and scoring a million touchdowns. It was Nick Chubb doing almost all of that, which I think it leads to why Baker has such an affection for Nick Chubb. But that's a side point. As that game and the way that, you know, he throws a touchdown in the fourth quarter to bring him back, that game to me showed me everything that I needed to see about what the guy can do, particularly when you throw the rest of his career into the mix as far as that pressure, you know, situation is concerned. And so I had basically seen everything that I had needed to see when it came to his on-field performance. You then, you know, kind of go through the whole process, and I'm trying to find out, is there any kind of go through disqualifying things? Are the hands big enough? Is he actually tall enough? Does he, you know, and then they do the stupid... You know, there's a couple of easy rules. One of them is the three-year rule. Another one that I've talked about recently that really is, should be a rule is, and it is my rule, is that you absolutely cannot look at metrics or combine results or statistics or anything other than tape, excuse me, if you're going to evaluate a quarterback coming out of the draft or going into the draft coming out of school. You just can't. There's nothing. There is nothing that is going to tell you more. And unfortunately, what that means is there's no way to shorthand it. You just got to go in and you just got to watch the film and you just got to. And if you love football, it shouldn't be all that hard to do. And that does actually make you, you know, kind of. It does actually cause you to watch games differently over time when you do that enough. So, you know, there's nothing that happened within that offseason that dispelled anything that that I had seen on the tape. So then you start looking at the attitude thing. And the point of all of this is that in the run-up, you could see that there was something about this guy that was special, and it wasn't just the talent. It wasn't just the, and I mean, and you and I both know by now, deadly accuracy. I mean, I don't know that I really mean this. I don't know that I've ever seen anybody come out of college and be as accurate as Baker has been, both while he was in college and at the NFL level, right off the rip. Guy is amazingly accurate. You know, he had a game 2 weeks ago where he flat out did not miss a pass. You know, there was two drops and a throwaway or whatever it was. And he's had a couple of halves like that this year where he's played basically perfect. The guy, you know, so the unbelievable accuracy is one thing. There was no doubt about the arm strength. But the thing I was going to say about the easy rule, what needs to be codified into preeminence as one of these easy rules of mine, is that the combine velocity measurements, and I'm very serious, please, I'm willing to debate anybody on this. The combine velocity measurements are worthless. They are, and I don't even know what Baker's score was. I think that he was actually, him and Allen were like right there. But I don't care. I'll say it again. The combine velocity measurements are worthless. They mean nothing. They have no value. They are, if you were to take a blank piece of paper, that blank piece of paper has more value than the combine velocity measurements. Now, why do I say that? I say that because they don't actually measure how hard the guys throw. What they do is they take the guys when they are just kind of doing their passing drills, and they clock them when they're not expecting it to happen. If you line the guys up and said, all right, throw it as hard as you can, and then gauge the velocity, now we're talking about something. But they don't do that. Ergo, the combine velocity measurements are worthless. And I don't know why I'm so passionate about this. It's just because people put so much stock in it, and it's stupid to put stock in those measurements. Deshaun Watson, by everybody's eye for the combine velocity measurements, shouldn't be able to play NFL quarterback and take a look at what he's doing. So, all that to say, you know, like the combine in many cases, really for anybody, it really just kind of confirms or will deconfirm something that you have already made a determination about a given player, about a prospect. But the one thing that it can't measure is the attitude, and the one thing it can't measure is the intangibles, and the one thing that when it comes to it really it can't tell you a whole lot about a quarterback except, you know, I mean if it's really really close between two guys, okay, then maybe what happens at the combine can sway you one way or the other. Same thing with the pro day. It's just not that important in the overall evaluation of the quarterback. And when you looked at the total picture, everything about what this kid is doing this year could have been seen. It's understandable why people didn't see it for, you know, reasons that I've mentioned earlier. But when I watch him go out there and talk about how the team, it's like when after the Bengals, when he was explaining to the reporters, you know, you'll notice about him that he'll always do everything he can to deflect kind of praise. He's like, hey, you know, my job's to put the ball in the playmaker's hands, let them do all the work. Yeah, okay, Baker, you just got done setting all the protections, reading the defense, delivering a perfect strike and hitting the guy. Yeah, but that's what he does. He's trying to buck up the rest of it. And like I've said before, the guy actually demonstrates a lot of really upper-level leadership-type skill. I mean, the guy is like, aside from everything else, he's older than his years in terms of his wisdom when it comes to this sort of thing. But he's very definitive when he talks about these team things. When he was talking about the Cincinnati situation, he's talking about, he's like, yeah, well, you know, that guy was, he was here, you know, and then he, you know, trying to get us to play hard for him, and then he leaves and he goes and plays for our division rival, and, you know, people can say whatever they want about it, but that's the way I feel about it, and that's the way the team should feel about it. And I heard that it was kind of subtle, but it was also very firm. And I loved it, and I love it now. I love it when the guy goes out there and talks about this. And not from a, you know, it's one thing to be cocky, it's another thing to be confident. And actually, I don't have a problem with you if you're cocky. It's not cocky if you can back it up, right? That's what they say. It ain't bragging if it's true. And the guy goes out there, and he backs it up. So when, you know, when I see that, it what it tells me is that what my analysis was about the intangible nature of his character, the fact that he does have this sort of internal mental toughness that allowed him to be the first walk-on to start an FBS opener as a true freshman, and then become the first walk-on after transferring midway through his college career and walking on to another big university, a big-name college, to win the Heisman, be the only player ever to win the Heisman as a walk-on, to set the passing efficiency mark in his junior year and then go back and break his own record his senior year. It demonstrated and then, again, on top of that, listening to the way his players talked about him, it painted the picture of a guy that not only had Herculean traits, I mean, a guy that was head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of what he could do with the football, but then on top of that, these intangible leadership qualities that I think that we are seeing in SCADs and have seen all year. And I got to be honest, I had no intention of sitting here talking about Mayfield's leadership abilities for the first almost half hour of the program here tonight, but it is the thing about him that truly makes him special. There have been other accurate guys. There have been other guys that have had, you know, great arm strength. And Baker's got an arm. It's not Mahomes and it's not Josh Allen, but the Baker's got plenty of arm. I mean, he's like maybe the next tier down from those guys. But arm strength, we talked about it before, arm strength is probably, when you really get down to, like, well, you have to have enough of it, right? You have to meet a threshold. But then once you meet that threshold, it's probably like the sixth or seventh most important thing. And that's just off the top of my head. There's probably even more things that are more important than that. Because you got all kinds of guys that can throw the ball really hard. Doesn't matter if you can't read a defense. Doesn't matter if you can't, you know, keep pressure or keep yourself composed under pressure. That play at the goal line on Saturday night, the touchdown pass to Callaway. I talked about it after the game, and since then, you know, the more people have taken the time to really break it down. It's the type of stuff that you just don't see rookies do. You just don't see rookies totally, you know, get the team, you know, on the same page after converting a big third down, get the team on the same page, get them lined up, change the protection, and then you see that little smirk, you know, as he goes up to the line. What does that say? That smirk means, I got you. Whatever you do, we're going to score here. And then that's exactly what happened. Guys, we've never had that. I love Bernie. Bernie was never what Baker is. I know it. I know. That's a tough thing to say. I know it. And I love the very first Browns game I ever went to was a Monday night game against the Miami Dolphins, where I watched Bernie Kosar bring us back from being down 20-3 in the fourth quarter. He brought us all the way back. We ended up losing the game anyway, but he brought us back from down 17 points in the fourth quarter on a broken freaking ankle. And I will always love Bernie Kosar. But I don't think Bernie Kosar at his best was as good as what Baker Mayfield is about to be. I won't say that at his best he was never as good as Baker is now. Baker's a rookie, and he's going to have, probably even these last two games, he's going to have some rookie moments. Have you ever seen a rookie as good as him, though? But the point is that, and look, Bernie was smart, don't get me wrong. Bernie was outstanding. Bernie is just as excited about Mayfield as anybody else. In fact, one of the great moments of my Browns watching life was the first preseason game of this year when Tim Couch is calling the game and Bernie is on the sidelines and they are both just gushing, just, oh my God, can you see what he's doing? Oh my, he's amazing. Like, you could just tell that they were just so excited that the Browns had finally gotten a real true franchise quarterback. And those guys were both, you know, kind of our last two legit shots. Tim Couch gets I should probably do a whole thing on Tim Couch one day. I'm a big Tim Couch fan as far as what he could have been when he was here in Cleveland. By the way, Bruce Arians was here when he was here in Cleveland and thinks the same thing about Tim Couch. Either way, the kid is special, and he's special because of those intangibles, that leadership quality, and that is going to end up paying such huge dividends for us over time. It's so refreshing to see this, and it really does mean, you know, that game on Saturday night, and when I get back here, I'm going to talk about Jabril Peppers and I didn't give him, I don't think, enough due credit for his performance on Saturday night and that final play, what that was really all about. But that game on Saturday night, you know and I know, that's a game we never win. We never win that game. You go for it on fourth and one, and then you have the guy, you know, offsides, but then we call the penalty. You know, total Brownsiest thing ever, right? Brownsiest, and then we get stuffed on fourth and one, and they take over. You just knew we were going to lose, right? You just knew that they were going to go, and it didn't happen. Now, I realize Baker doesn't play defense, but I'm saying that you watch the way this team played when Hugh Jackson was the coach, and nothing against Tyrod Taylor, but when he was the quarterback, or better yet, go back to last year with DeShone Kaiser. And nothing against Kaiser, but Kaiser's a rookie. Kaiser is a real rookie. Baker Mayfield's not a rookie. I mean, he's definitely not a rookie anymore. I realize that he literally is, but you've never seen a rookie play like that. I've never seen a rookie play like that. Even Andrew Luck, I would put Baker's rookie year up against Andrew Luck. He may actually end up beating all of the records as far as touchdowns and yards and all that before it's all said and done if he has two big games left against the Bengals and the Ravens. But when I get back, I'm going to talk about Pepper's performance and the coaching situation and the way for us to move forward. But it's all about Baker. And the fact that we have, you know, and it's all about the quarterback no matter what team you have. But the one that we got is so special. And it's definitely a reason to be thankful in this holiday season. My name is Easy Weave. This is Easy Does It on Dogs by Nature. And I'll be right back.
It's the most.
If you've been a listener for any length of time, you know that my opinion of Jabril Peppers has not been the strongest, really, ever since I did not have him ranked particularly high. I talked myself into him once we drafted him and then watched him have a terrible rookie season and was willing to you know, make not a commitment necessarily, but I was willing to prognosticate that maybe this guy is an exception to the easy rule in the sense that maybe he's not going to make it. You know, maybe he's just not. Maybe he's a guy that you can already write off after 1 year because his performance is that bad. But you know, this year I haven't noticed him as much. I haven't noticed him making as many mistakes. I can't say that I've really watched him more intently just because of the nature of the position that he plays is off screen a lot and. All year long, I've been functioning without the All-22, and, you know, it's a cross-eyed bear. But I found out this last week that, you know, Pro Football Focus, which is not the, you know, the end-all, be-all, you know, I always have to throw that disclaimer in, they are not the Bible. They are simply guys that watch the games, they watch all the players, and they put grades out. And look, since they are the only ones that are doing it, they ipso facto become the authority on the matter. I got a whole thing about PFF. All that to say that it's fine to, you know, be off when it comes to a game or a particular performance. Like a couple years ago when Drago beat the Ravens, they said it actually wasn't a good game, and I thought, okay, this is worthless. But they've got Jabril Peppers ranked 10th within the top 10. They have him ranked as the 9th ranked safety in the league. And that's not really something that is probably prone to either bias or small sample size or what have you. That's based on their analysis, and that's kind of amazing, considering the rookie year that he had. So then you go to the game on Saturday night, and I had made kind of a big deal about it having been his best game because he made what I considered to be a safety play, you know, where he read the ball in the air, you know, tracked it and made a critical, you know, the way that the game turned out, a critical interception that took, you know, a red zone interception in the end zone, took points away from them, crucial spot. And that was a bit. Of course, we couldn't do anything with it because Baker had the challenging first half. But, you know, and by the way, apparently there were people that were taking umbrage with my criticism of Baker because of his performance on Saturday night after the broadcast. I mean, I don't know what to tell you guys. I love the kid, as you should well know after if you heard the first half hour of this thing. I'm running out of superlatives to describe how much I love this kid. But I got to be honest, when he struggles, he struggled. And he struggled in the first half, came back and played like a boss in the second half. Okay, it is what it is. But Peppers came back on the final play of the real, you know, the final play of the game that mattered against the Donkeys. And he came through on the blitz at the end of the game and took out Case Keenum. And when it happened, you know, it's kind of like the euphoria of, oh my God, we actually were going to win this game. And you look at it at first blush and you think, wow, that's great scheming by Greg. That's a great call, right moment. And he's able to get through. What I didn't know, what I didn't learn until a couple of days later, is what I'm about to tell you. And that is that it wasn't just a well-timed and opportune, you know, blitz package that caused the success there. What I discovered was that Peppers actually did quite a bit of innovation on that particular play. Because earlier in the game, the Broncos had lined up in a similar formation. And he noticed that the tight end, I want to say the guy Lacrosse, whatever the guy, the tight end there, Lacoste, the dude they had there playing at tight end, in a similar formation and similar down in distance and so on, they had run a similar type play, and he noticed that the tight end had moved outside to take on the outside pressure. And he read that, and he adjusted, because on this assignment, on this play, he was supposed to loop out to the end, and knowing that that was where he was going to go, and that earlier in the game, in a similar spot, the Broncos had rotated Lacoste out there to take out the outside rusher, he made a modification. And he said after the game, he's like, you know, if you're effective blitzers know their protections. And that's exactly what he did. But that's not the only thing that he did. He also, after making that read, instead of looping around the end, instead he shot between the gap between the guard and the tackle. But that's not the only thing that he did. He also kind of spoofed himself behind the tackles and the linebackers, so that way the quarterback and the guard that was back there, the running back that was back there to pick up any inside pressure, didn't even see him until he was screaming through the hole. And by that point, you know, there was Case Keenum had no shot. There was nothing he could do except try to make a move. And also on the tackle, you know, you figure when you got that sort of head of steam and you got that sort of free shot, how many times have we seen, you know, a guy like Mingo just totally run past the guy and miss him because he pulls a move? Or worse yet, you got a free shot at the guy, you want to take him down, so you end up crowning him, or you end up hitting him high, or you end up doing something the way the league is played right now, where you end up getting a unnecessary roughness, roughing the passer penalty. And yet the tackle that he made was perfect. It took him down and the game was over. I didn't realize all of that watching the game. And when I came here to talk about his performance, I was certainly laudatory, and I was speculating that, you know, maybe we actually got something out of that first-round pick. But when I learned all of this, I got to, eat a little bit of crow here. Jabril, you know, if you're out there listening, Bubba, I love you. I've always loved you. I've loved the attitude on the kid. Like I've said before, if I had a college-aged daughter, Jabril Peppers is exactly the sort of young man that I would want her to commiserate with, to go in a courting relationship, whatever, you know, end up with. Because I just think he's a really awesome guy. But that's different from necessarily what I think about, you know, his football acumen. But I'm just saying, if you're out there listening, Jabril, man, you proved me wrong. And you have, I mean, when I realized what your PFF score, and again, it's not the end-all, be-all, but you know, if you're like one of the worst safeties in the league, they're not going to accidentally have you in the top 10, okay? So congratulations on turning it around, big boy. You got it done. And congratulations on that the performance on Saturday night. It was dominating, quite honestly. Yeah, maybe dominating is a strong word, but it was great. It was a fantastic performance, and the play at the end there, man. You know, all you. I'm very, very proud of Jabril Peppers and the way that he's performed, because that's a guy that, you know, I love watching that, the story of guys that are struggling like that, and it does seem like it's not going to work out for him. And you see him work hard, because he's a grinder. Maybe that's why I like him so much, because he is a guy that just goes out there. There was never any doubt about the effort. There was never any doubt about the heart. It was just the thought of, you know, some guys just are, you know, just never clicks for him. You know, I kind of thought he had the Craig Robertson syndrome, where just, you know, he needs to see everything develop in front of him. Butt made that comparison the other day. I've always thought that was a great comparison, but evidently not. So it was worth spending some additional time to give some kudos to Jabril Peppers and the season that he's had. And look, if there's, you know, some further improvement going into his third year, hey, I mean, this is potentially a very, very good player playing alongside a very, very good player in the secondary already with Demaryius Randle. And by the way, one of the other guys in the secondary, Denzel Ward, by our other hotshot rookie. Congratulations, Meathead, because one of your guys, well, both of your top picks, your first and four, and actually I think Chubbers got in there too. I think that Meathead's three of his top four picks either made the Pro Bowl or were alternates. Baker was an alternate, and I'm almost positive Chubbers is an alternate. I know that both the guards are Zeitler and Betonio. And, of course, Miles made the team. He's in the Pro Bowl. And I think that when the All-Pro team is announced, I would be very surprised if he is not at least a second-team All-Pro. The season that Miles Garrett has had has just been he really has been dominating this entire season, and can't possibly be more proud of him. I as much as I love Jabril Peppers, I love Miles Garrett even more. I love this team, quite honestly. With the personalities that are on here and the talent that's there, but, you know, I mentioned two guys that I love, and I love Baker Mayfield. I mean, I can't. You know, I don't have the words to describe how much I love that guy. But there's a lot of players that are like that. That are on this team, and just congratulations to all the players that are on this roster that made it to the Pro Bowl. Even if it's as alternates, you know, that's hearty recognition. I realize the Pro Bowl doesn't mean, you know, what it used to mean, and it mostly is a popularity contest. I don't care. You know, I think that if all of them were to play, which is highly unlikely, Britton Colquitt was one of them, I think we'd have like eight Pro Bowlers, which is, I mean, that's amazing for, you know, consider the turnaround that we've had this year. And it also should pretty well substantiate in the mind of anybody out there watching, we don't have a talent problem on this roster. We have had a coaching problem. And we're going to be reminded of that coaching problem to some degree this weekend when our beloved Orange Helmets take on the Oranger Helmets of the Cincinnati Bengals, who will be having Hugh Jackson drive the bus back in. There's the word on the street that Marvin Lewis is going to be moved into a more front office, more kind of executive role with the team. And there's a lot of, you know, rumors that it's going to be Hugh Jackson that's going to take over for him. And this is just a public service announcement to any member of the Bengals organization that may have gotten their hands on this cast and is listening right now. Mike Brown, or any of the other people that are within the organization. Marvin Lewis, you know, yourself, if you happen to be out there hearing this. I, Easy Weave, cannot more fully endorse and recommend with all of the sincerity that I can possibly muster in this lifetime and all that follow, for you to go ahead and promote Hugh Jackson to the head coaching position at whatever point in time. I would do it right now. You know, go ahead and elevate Marvin Lewis to the front office spot, and go ahead and let Huey take it over for this game. He's got a lot going for him. He had that one kind of mediocre year with the Raiders, and then he's a quarterback whisperer. You may not know this about him, but he's an offensive genius, and so it's a really smart move. And I you know, as a friend, as somebody who cares, I think that it would be really wise for you to make that move, and I implore you to do that. And that's coming from me. I'm not being paid by anybody here. This is this is straight from the bottom of my full and voluminous heart that I make the recommendation for you people in Bangaland to go ahead and roll with Hugh Jackson. You definitely will not regret it. I know that I won't. But as we prepare for Cincinnati and Hugh Jackson coming into town back again, the coaching situation for us really has taken center stage because this isn't anything new. I talked about this on Saturday. The playoffs pretty much ended when we got beat up by the Texans. We held in there, and I realize right now after the Steelers went and beat the Patriots on Saturday night or on a Sunday night, basically, which is just, you know, another log on the fire. Why I hate those SOBs, but we. Also, the Titans and the Colts both won, so we are down now to exactly one playoff scenario. So we're not technically, mathematically eliminated, but it ain't gonna happen. But I will talk about what that playoff scenario is, and I'm gonna talk about the coaching situation as it pertains to what happens next, because a postseason isn't going to happen, but there is going to be an after season, and there's some possibilities there. And I'm going to hit that up along with the crazy not going to happen playoff scenario when we return to Easy Does It with me, Easy Weave, here on Dogs by Nature.
Oh, there's no place like home for the holiday. 'Cause no matter how far away you roam, if you want to be happy in a million ways, for the holidays you can't beat home sweet home.
Okay, so here it is. The Titans and the Colts both have to lose this weekend to the Giants and the Redskins, respectively. Redskins, I think, are trotting out Josh Johnson, who won last week, as a matter of fact. And the Giants, of course, still have the husk of Eli Manning and the sensational rookie Saquon Barkley. And so maybe you have some hope there. So both of those teams have to lose. And if both of those teams lose, then... Oh, and also the Ravens have to lose to the Chargers, but that seems a little bit more like it will happen. And then that would set up the final week of the year, where, of course, we would have to beat... And by the way, the Dolphins would have to lose one of the next two games, too, and I'm not really even counting them in this scenario, because it doesn't really matter, because it's not going to happen. But we then, of course, have to beat Baltimore the final week of the year, which would essentially eliminate them from playoff contention. And then, like I say, the Dolphins would have to lose either this week or next week, and I don't even know who they're playing, but it's, you know, whoever it is has a shot. And then my favorite part of all of this is that then the Titans and the Colts play each other, and they would have to tie. And if they tied, we would get the final playoff spot by virtue of having a better record in the division. Because if we win these last two games, listen to this next thing I'm about to say here, because this is unbelievable. If we win this game, if we win the next two games, and we finish out the year, then that means we're going to have a division record of 4-1-1. When was the last time that we had a record that good in the division? I honestly don't even know. I think the last time we had a winning record period in the division was 1994. But I'm not even sure about that. And I will also say that, the two blemishes on there, of course, come to these those hateable SOBs over in the hills, and your time's coming. If any of you Steeler people are out there, I'm just letting you. Your time is coming, but that's for the future. because we'll have a winning record in the a better record in the division than either the Titans or Colts, if this absolutely 100% not going to happen scenario does in fact occur, then we would get into the final wild card spot if, you know, the Dolphins also lose one of the next two games and the Ravens lose to the Chargers this weekend. And at that point, we would take on the number three seed, and right now that looks to be either the Texans or the Patriots. I would love to see a Baker versus Tom Brady matchup. That would be so great. But it's not going to happen, and I get it. But that's where we stand. So, look, it's week 16, and there's... it's a crazy scenario that isn't going to happen. We're still talking about a chance the Browns could make it in. And that's, again, another testament to Baker Mayfield. Also a testament to John Dorsey. And, yes, also Sashi Brown. Speaking of John Dorsey, affectionately known here... and in wide circles as Meathead, and the story of that, by the way, is he came on after Sashi Brown. Sashi Brown's a very erudite guy, very extraordinarily articulate, and just awesome wordsmith. And you listen to the guy, and you could tell just this intelligence oozing off of him. But he was also very good at like not saying whatever it was that he was saying while he was saying it. He could tell you a whole bunch of things that made it sound like he was giving you an answer, but then when you really go back and examine it, he really didn't tell you anything that he didn't want you to know. So then you bring John Dorsey along, and that ain't him. John Dorsey is just a different type of guy. But you know what? It accomplishes the same thing. And he's done, I think, you know, we're only a year into this, and certainly it takes some time, but I don't think that you can complain even a little bit with the performance that John Dorsey has had. So, I mean, flat out, Meathead's done a great job. Great job. I mean, if you're listening, John Dorsey, bravo, buddy. I mean, you deserve a 10-year extension based on what, of course, you know, between you and me, you were pretty much my guy as soon as you drafted Baker. And that was the deal, by the way. I made it a point to tell everybody that if he drafted Baker, I'm good forever. So, you know, recently he came out and talked about the coaching situation and really kind of intimated that, well, I shouldn't say that. He kind of sort of inferred that he would be the one conducting the search. I think the fact that he was the only one giving the press conference talking about this is a pretty good indication that he's going to have a large role in all of this. And, of course, as it was all unfolding, I was very adamant that if Jimmy Haslam is going to be the one making this decision, then I'm not really interested in him making that decision or a change even being made at that point. But that if Dorsey would have the reins to do it, then I would be for that. Well, we're now getting to the end of the year, and it really is a time for choosing. It's a big decision time coming up, and there's a lot of factors to discuss here. And the first, probably most glaring of which, has been the performance of Greg Williams. Greg Williams, coming into this year, you know, I've been very critical of his the performance of his defense, not just coming into this year, but this year. Guys being out of position a lot, and just what I would consider to be a poor performance in many ways. Maybe unfair, but, you know, I especially with all the bluster that the guy came in with, I expected a little bit more. But I got to tell you something. The guy, as a head coach, has performed. That team comes out there prepared and fired up to play every week. And it was evident from the first game they came out and played against the Chefs, if you'll remember. We didn't really have a shot in that game because, like, half of our three-quarters of our defense was injured. So, you know, you have an all-pro offense that's going up against a completely depleted defense. Yeah, we didn't stand a chance in that one. But you could tell that there was a difference in the overall quality of the effort that was given. And the next week, we go out there and we soundly beat the Falcons. The 2 weeks after that, after the bye week, we go out there and smack down the Bengals in our first legitimate beatdown of any team in forever. And you can just, you know, and okay, then, yeah, we took a bath in Houston, but then come back strong the next 2 weeks and beat two teams that were vying for playoff spots. Beat those two teams. So, Greg Williams, you know, he's performed way, way above my expectations. And I've gotten to a point now where I think he legitimately deserves a shot. A lot of it has to do in these last two games. You know, Baker out there saying that that the guys need to perform. You know, if they don't, like, if they go out there this week and lay a turd and just don't, you know, show up against the Bengals and you know, act like they're kind of going through the motions, then that's gonna reflect on Greg. However, if they go out there and beat him down as badly as they beat him up the first time around, and they stand a pretty good shot to do that with one of my favorite quarterbacks, you know, playing right now, Jeff Driskel, at the helm. If we're able to go out there and do that, then I think that the case keeps building. Much tougher game next week against the Ravens, I think. But look, that's a team that we've already beaten this year. So it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility that we could do it again. But if that were to happen, if we were to go out there in these last 2 weeks and beat two teams that we've already beaten this year, and one of those, you know, But if we go out and we do that, then that's going to mean a 6-2 record on the year. And that's for an interim coach taking over midseason, that's pretty amazing. I don't even recall a team performing like that after a coach has gotten fired ever. To see a team turn around that, and when you see it that such a stark difference in the way that the team performs, you know, at some point you have to say, well, okay, how much is this is just what a terrible coach Hugh Jackson was? And yeah, I think there's something to that, but I think at some point, and I'm pretty much there, you have to look at, well, what kind of job is Greg Williams doing over there? But he's not the only one. A lot of people, and certainly I'm, among those, and I don't, you know, I usually am not the one, I it doesn't matter to me to be like this, I was the first one to say that, but I guarantee, because I think it was like before the Chiefs game, I was talking about Freddie Kitchens being a head coach, and look, I just say stuff, so that's not like me having some, you know, deep analysis on the situation, but now Freddie Kitchens has performed very, very well as the kind of the interim offensive coordinator. There is a little bit of word out there that that he's already secured the offensive coordinator spot for 2019, which is a really perplexing thing. I just don't know how you do that. We'll get to all that. My point is, there's a lot of talk that maybe if Greg either doesn't want to do the job or if he stumbles these last couple weeks, that maybe it's worth, you know, giving Freddie Kitchens a look as the next head coach. And a lot of that is predicated on the notion that, you know, he's done so well with Baker, we can't break him up. We can't break up that combination. We need to be able to stay, you know, have them stay together. And so that's an option. That certainly is one of the things that's out there. And then you've got the other one, which is the perpetual drumbeat that Bruce Arians, who is like my crush when it comes to coaches, is that he's interested and would come back and potentially be a candidate to coach, and has said that he would only come coach the Browns. I think in the scenario where either we decided to keep Greg Kitchens, if we decided to keep Greg Williams as the head coach, or if we were to bring on Bruce Arians, I think that's probably about the only scenario whereby Freddie Kitchens could reasonably be expected to be held over next year as the offensive coordinator. Because if you're going to go out and hire, you know, whoever it is that you like out there, if you like Lincoln Riley, if you like Dave Taub, if you like whoever it is that you like out there as the next head coach, well, you can't really bring that guy in and say, oh, yeah, but you got to take on Freddie Kitchens as your offensive coordinator. Just like you can't say that, oh, yeah, you got to take on Greg Williams as your defensive coordinator. You can't do it. In the first place, it severely limits the pool of candidates that you can talk to. But, you know, more importantly than that, why do you want to hamstring your coach that way? It sets up a situation where, you know, in a year or so, if things aren't working, he's going to say, well, you know, I'd be doing a lot better if I had my guys, but I don't have my guys. You stuck me with these guys. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So then people say, well, you know, if that's the case, then just make Freddie Kitchens the head coach because we can't break this up. And look, guys, I love Freddie Kitchens. I mean, Freddie Kitchens I just think he's an awesome human being, number one. You know, there's a video out there of him somewhere from when he was with the Cardinals, and Carson Palmer's talking about how he worked like all these crazy hours when he was there as a coach, but then his one day off on Christmas Day, he dresses up like Santa Claus and comes over and gives presents to Carson Palmer's kids just to be a good guy. And his story he talks about is hilarious. He's like, yeah, and he's got this Southern accent, so he's trying to talk like Santa, but he's all Southern, which just makes me laugh. Because, you know, I live in the South, and I just think I just love that whole attitude, you know, that he's over there trying to give the kids a good time and stuff. And that's not the only thing, but the point is that I like Freddie Kitchens as a man. I think he's done a fantastic job as an offensive coordinator. And I don't want to get too far away from this whole Greg thing, but when it comes to Freddie Kitchens, when it comes to Kitcho, I think it would be fantastic if he could come back next year in some capacity as the offensive, or I should say, in the capacity as the offensive coordinator somehow, some way. And I mentioned the ways that I think that it's actually possible. And that would be if Greg were to retain the job and be made the full-time head coach, not just the interim head coach, which I think he's actually earned so far. He's got to finish off these last two games, certainly, to kind of seal the deal, in my mind anyway. And Arians, who has said multiple times that, you know, that this would be the team that he would come back to, and the only team that he would come back to, and it stands to reason. He sees what I see when it comes to Baker, and what you see when it comes to, you know, franchise quarterback guy could be a, you know, right now Baker's playing like a first ballot Hall of Famer when you project his career from rookie. So Arians sees that, and he's looking at it from like, yeah, I'd like to go coach that. I can get into that. And if you don't know, there's a history with Arians and Kitchens from when they were in Arizona. But look, even if Greg Williams were to be retained, there's no guarantee that he would keep Kitchens on as offensive coordinator. I think that he probably would, but there's no guarantee. And I'll tell you something else, there's no guarantee that if Bruce Arians were to take over the job, that Freddie Kitchens would accept it, that he would be the offensive coordinator. Maybe he didn't like working for Arians before. Arians did demote him from, I think, quarterback coach to running back coach when he was out in Arizona. So there's a lot of things to consider here. But the idea of moving Freddie Kitchens to head coach because of the relationship that he has with Baker Mayfield, that is something that I really start to slam the brakes on and say, okay, we really got to think about this, guys. And the reason for me anyway that it's kind of, it's appropriate to say, close to home. You know, I live maybe two blocks away from, I live 3 miles away from, two huge blocks, I guess, away from Raymond James Stadium, where the Tampa Bay Buccaneers supposedly play football during the fall. And they have undergone this really bizarre couple of seasons. And it's culminating now in, you know, they were officially eliminated from playoff contention. They went out and got the hell knocked out of them by somebody last Sunday. The Ravens, as a matter of fact. At this point, it looks like they're probably going to end up blowing out everybody as far as the coaching staff, but in the front office possibly. And this was a team that had fairly high expectations coming into the year. And I have always been a fan of the Buccaneers. You know, they are kind of my second love after the Browns, but it's like, it's kind of like, I don't know. It's like if you had a real child. But then, like, you know, when you take, you know, the neighbor's kid, like, hangs out every once in a while, and is like, yeah, okay, well, when my real kid isn't around, you know, this kid's kind of cool, and, you know, I like him just fine, and he's all right. This is a terrible analogy. It really is. I'm just saying that the sense of, you know, community and commitment that I have to the Browns, it just doesn't compare to, it's so far above and beyond that for the Buccaneers, I kind of look at everything standing from the outside, but not as somebody that is this passionate about the situation. All that means is that I've observed all of this as somebody that cares, but not somebody that is so invested like I am with the Browns, where I'll admit it, there are times where I'm so desirous of our success and our turnaround that, you know, I've talked myself into things that turned out not to be the case. And that's that whole, you know, analysis paralysis where you are so, you know, can't see the forest for the trees and all of that. So as I look at the Bucs situation, I go back to, you know, how it all started. They had a terrible year, went 2-14. That got them the first pick in the draft, and they selected Jameis Winston. Lovie Smith is the head coach. The next year, they come back, and he added Dirk Cutter to his staff. Because actually, I believe it was Jeff Tedford who was his offensive coordinator the year before, and he had the, I think it was a heart attack or something, and then Bronson Arroyo took over the play, calling it a big mess. And so he brings in Dirk Cutter, and Jameis Winston proceeds to have a pretty good rookie year. He started right off the right out of the gate, and had a pretty good rookie year. Not Baker good, but it was pretty good. And the thought down in Tampa land was that it was so important to keep Dirk Cutter around as head coach that, or to keep him around, that even if it meant cutting Lovie Smith, who had improved, you know, Lovie improved that team from 2-14 to, you know, 6-10. Not that it was a major improvement, but he did improve the team. That they decide, because it was rumored, it was thought that maybe Dirk was going to get offers from people to be their head coach. So to preempt that, the Bucks said, no, this relationship that Dirk has with Jameis is too important. We're going to elevate him to the head coach and continue developing Jameis Winston. So now we look at the situation 4 years later, and this is, you know, irrespective of all of the stuff that happened at the beginning of the year with, not to absolve him, I'm not saying anything about it. I'm not making a judgment call. I'm not making any kind of call on it. I'm just saying, if you don't even look at that, if you just look at the performance on the field, yeah, I think that it's safe to say that after 4 years, there's, you know, probably some disappointment and some expectations that things would be better. Which is to say, the whole point of keeping Dirk around was to be able to develop Jameis Winston into a, you know, high caliber passer, and he obviously hasn't done that, at least to the extent that people's expectations were. And then on top of that, he's kind of proven to be a pretty lousy head coach. So what did the Bucks actually accomplish? They wanted to elevate Dirk so that way they could keep the training on Jameis. But what happens when you become the head coach? You're not the offensive coordinator anymore. Now, yeah, it's there's nothing particularly revelatory for me to say to you that, you know, coordinators don't necessarily make it as head coach. Oh, really? Easy? Is that you know, that's fascinating that you've stumbled upon that incredible truth of the world. But the thing about this is that Freddie Kitchens has had a tremendous impact. Positively, we presume, has had a tremendous positive, and I think so. I think that there's a lot of merit to the fact that he's had a tremendous positive impact on Baker Mayfield's development as the offensive coordinator. But understand that if he's the head coach, he's not going to be the offensive coordinator anymore. He's going to be the head coach. Head coach has a whole different set of responsibilities. The head coach is going to have to necessarily have his focus on bigger things than development of individual players. Not that there's anything more important than the quarterback, but I'm just saying that you may want to spend all of your time developing it, but you know what? Developing that player. But if you're going to do that, then that means you're going to end up farming out the other head coaching responsibilities that you have. Because for all the bluster about, that's not bluster. For what people, you know, see as what a coach ought to be in order to be successful, a lot of times in this day and age, coaches are really kind of administrators as much as anything else. And they got to be leaders of men, and they got to be motivators, and they got to be, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago about what, you know, what Meathead's standards are, what my standards are, and all this. I don't know that Freddie Kitchens isn't a tremendous head coach material. I don't know that. I've seen enough of him. I think he's a high caliber, a high character guy. That's one of Dorsey's stipulations. I think he's a high character guy. He certainly seems to be football knowledgeable, and for all accounts, he looks like he's a teacher of young men, particularly the most important of our young men, one Baker Mayfield. So he has those boxes checked. Now, to me, like I've talked about, I think that's kind of the prerequisite to get in the door. What you need beyond that is the ability to effectively scheme a game plan. And actually, that's not even number one. The number one thing is the promotion of harmony or unity. That was another thing Michael Irvin talked about. Harmony. Lack of discord. All of us being on the same page-ness. You know, however you want to call it, that ability to do that and to get everybody on the same page, that's a big deal. That's the number one most important thing to me. That's my, you know, first thing. The second thing is the effective ability to scheme a game plan. Well, Kitcho can do that. We've seen that. And then, can you be resilient? And can you come back when your scheme doesn't work? And you know what? I think we've seen him do that as well. So I'm not trying to say that Freddie Kitchens wouldn't be a good head coach. I honestly don't know. I don't know that he even wants to be the head coach. That's another big thing about this, too, is whether or not a guy wants to be the coach. It's kind of the really question about Greg. Does Greg want to be the head coach? Because he's kind of said earlier that he didn't want to be the head coach. That he liked coaching defense. He wanted to coach defense. It kind of looks to me like he's loving it, though. And it also looks to me like he's pretty good at it. So we'll see. But if Freddie Kitchens wants to be the head coach, then yeah, I think that he deserves a look. And I don't know that he couldn't be, maybe even a great one. I don't know. But what I do know is that he's not going to have the same role as head coach as he had as offensive coordinator. So if the whole impetus of retaining him is because of the way that he has this rapport with Baker and the way that he has been bringing him along, you know, training-wise, you're going to lose that. You're going to lose a lot of that, necessarily. Because as head coach, he's going to have a different set of priorities. He has to. He's got to overwatch the entire team. He can't just spend all of his time focusing on one position group. And he's not a coordinator anyway. That's not his role. And I understand that coaches do different things depending on the team that you're on. And he can set his own agenda however he wants. It's his team, right? If he's coaching it. But it just doesn't typically work out that way. And I'm watching it, you know, unfold down here in Tampa, where we didn't get the benefit of the quarterback development, and all we ended up with, from the Bucs' perspective, is a bad head coach for 4 years. That now is, well, 3 years that he's been in the role, and now he's going to get bumped up by somebody else. And it wouldn't surprise me if somebody else with a totally different crew comes in there, and Jameis looks like a rock star next year. Time will tell. But all this to say that while I would love to see Freddie Kitchens come back as the offensive coordinator, that's really going to only happen under a very slim set of circumstances that could possibly allow for that to happen. And I don't know how likely either of them are. At this point, I think my druthers would be, well, my fantasy would be, my what I would like to have happen more than anything else. And I know I get a lot of pushback on this, but I don't care. I would like to see Bruce Arians come in and take over the head coaching role with the caveat that Greg Williams goes back to coaching the defense and Freddie Kitchens stays on offense. And I think that that may be too far of a bridge right there. And that's also, by the way, assuming that Greg Williams doesn't want to be the head coach. So I'm saying my preferred option is that he doesn't want to be the coach, but he still wants to be on the team, and that allows Arians to walk in the door, and Arians has already said that he would keep Freddie Kitchens. Again, not sure if Freddie Kitchens would want to take the job, but, you know, we'll just take that at face value. And if the next best thing then for me, if it's not going to be Arians, would be to just keep Greg. If he wants the job, give it to him. He's earned it. He's earned the I don't know another interim coach that came in, and what's the winning percentage on it's 75%, 6 out of 8? Well, 3/4, you know, if you're 6 out of 8 wins. That's pretty good, you know. When was the last time an interim head coach had that? I'm speaking way far ahead of myself because he obviously hasn't done that yet. He has to go out there and prove it these last 2 weeks. But even if he does a split the next 2 games, you know, we go out there and we stomp the Bengals and lose a close one to the Ravens or vice versa. I think that he still has done enough to probably take the job. But most importantly, it's the way that he has gone about changing the attitude of this team. It seems to be perfectly symbiotic with our hotshot rookie quarterback. And maybe the relationship that Greg Williams has as a head coach is actually more beneficial to Baker Mayfield than would be the relationship he would have with Freddie Kitchens were he to take over as head coach. Now, I don't know any of this. I'm just speculating. But I think that these are all really serious, important questions because this is a very important, serious decision that we're making right here. And if we get it wrong, you know, this is the point that I was talking about today with some of the guys. That, you know, well, why not just promote Kitchens? Well, if you promote Kitchens and he's not a good head coach, you've potentially now shrunk Baker Mayfield's career by 4 years. Because you got his rookie year that was already hewed up for the first half of it. And you're going to have at least 2 years while you're muddling through your coach. And then you're going to have the first year of whoever the next guy is. So I'm not down with doing that. We really kind of got to get this right. And I'm like a lot of people. What's really been kind of encouraging to me is people have taken the tack this year that I took with Sashi Brown in previous years, talking about getting the quarterback and so on. But that a lot of people's resolution on this is, you know, I basically just trust whatever Dorsey's going to do. And I think Dorsey's kind of earned that as well. I think Dorsey's earned the trust to make that selection. But I'm just saying, for me, my first choice would be Bruce Arians taking over with Greg, with the stipulation that both Greg and Kitchens stay. And if that's not an option, my second choice would be that Greg Williams stays and continues as the head coach with Freddie Kitchens as offensive coordinator. And then after that, well, after that, you pretty much just got to plan on losing everybody. Because it it's just the way it is, guys. That's why I'm always railing against coaching changes. And that's, by the way, that's not motivating any of this. If we need to go get the guy, then go get the guy. If it's not Kitcho and it's not Greg and it's not Arians, then go get whoever the guy is. And if that means firing everybody on the staff that's currently on there, then all I'll ask is that you go to Amos Jones' office first. And then maybe hit it on the way back after you've done it to everybody else. Like, fire him, go fire everybody else, and then after you get back from the last guy's office that you fired, go back and fire Amos Jones a second time. Hopefully he's still there. And that's how I would do things. But because I'm saying, you're not going to keep these guys, is the point. If you hire a new coach, he's going to have his own guys. That's just the way it is. And I'm not even necessarily against that. It's how you have to do things. But if we go out into the world, the guy that I'm really kind of intrigued at is Dave Tube, the guy, or Taub, I don't know how you say his name, the guy from the special teams coordinator from Kansas City. And maybe I'll leave it there and we can talk about him next week on this non-postgame edition of Easy Does It With Me, Easy Weave here on Dogs by Nature. I can't believe I've already been talking for like almost an hour and 15 minutes. I had no thing. Like, I got home from work. I'm like, yeah, what am I going to talk about? So I just sat down and, you know, it's because I love you guys. And I can just sit here and off the top of my head extemporaneously, you know, have these conversations because I know that you're having them as well. And we're all kind of we're in this weird space right now where, man, the future looks incredible, but boy, we could screw it up by picking the wrong guy. Just look at the last guy we picked out. It's you know, it's a serious thing. But what else is serious is that we have a big game this week. It's going to be, you know, not Christmas Eve all the way. It's going to be 2 days before Christmas. And I am, you know, if you care at all about me, and I don't expect that you would or should, but if you do, and if anything that I say ever matters to you, then please, if you've never heeded anything that I've ever asked you to do, not that I've ever asked you to do a whole hell of a lot, if you have the ability, the wherewithal, the time, the disposable income, you know, whatever it is that you need to go to the game in Cleveland and attend it, I implore you to please, please do so. I cannot, and I'm not complaining about it. It's just the nature of my occupation has kept me in town in close proximity to. It's just the way it is, and it's fine. It's just the way it goes, and I'm not even. And I have a wonderful life. It's all good, but since I can't be there, I just if you have the ability to get there. Man, pack that thing out. Show those guys that have put up a really, really solid second half of the year, not just Baker, but all of them. Show them that you're still there. I know that you are. And I realize what these you don't have to tell me. I know what the last 20 years have been like. I know what the last 4 years have been like. I know what it's been like to be with this. You know, Baker says that, you know, I just like, I don't know what that's like. I don't ever want to know what that's like. Well, Baker brother, I know what it's like, and so do you. You know, all of you out there, I know that you know what it's like. And those days are done, thankfully. But we're not going to reach our full measure of success if we're unable to really make that right pick, and hopefully we will be able to do that. But you know, until that happens, we got one more home game. Man, pack that place out if you possibly can. Get there, go there, tailgate, hang out with all of your Browns brothers and sisters. Be merry. It's freaking Christmas. Go out there and enjoy. Give yourself the Christmas present of being in the dog pound with 75,000 of your closest friends rallying on our team while they kick the teeth in of the Cincinnati Bengals and allow Hugh Jackson to drive that bus away on down 271 back on down to, or is it 71? I always forget the interchange when you get down to going from Columbus to, I think that's 71 where you get from, or is it 77? I don't remember. The interstate that goes from Columbus to Cincinnati. And, you know, the next time I go up there, I'm going to take that route, and hopefully I'll be able to. And I really am kind of getting that itch that it is kind of time to go back to the land and just kind of visit. Maybe I'll do that and catch up with some of you wonderful folks that I've never actually got to meet in person. But I do enjoy talking to you, and I'll probably talk about this a little bit more on Sunday, but during the Christmas season, I get a little bit more grateful even than I am during Thanksgiving, even though that's the kind of the expressed appointed time where we're supposed to give thanks. But I really just appreciate all of you listening to these shows every week, and not just that, but the relationships that we have. Being a member of this rare fraternity of Browns people, especially those of you that have been here, and not to disparage any of you newbies that have come back along, or some of you oldbies that have come back. I don't blame you. Look, I am not going to sit here and cast judgment on any of you that said, to hell with this, I'm not watching this. And bailed over the last couple of years. And now are deciding to get back into the fold. Man, welcome. Welcome back. Arms extended. You know, it's totally fine. It wasn't worth watching the last couple of years. It was terrible. But now we got a good thing going on. And I appreciate this weird little thing that we have going on in our universe. Every day I appreciate it. And I appreciate you. And that's really all that I have to say about that. I hope that you have a wonderful rest of the weekend, and I look forward to speaking with you, hopefully on the heels of another Browns beatdown of the Bengals this Sunday. Until then, I hope that you are just as well as you can possibly be out there. Make it the best that it can be. Take care. Good luck. God bless. Merry Christmas!
Hey everybody, it's Neil Patel, Editor-in-Chief of The Verge. I host a podcast every week called The Vergecast with my friends Paul Miller and Dieter Bohn. We've got a rotating cast of characters from our entire site, which is about technology, how it impacts culture, and how that is all a big cycle that causes us to have a wide variety of feelings that you can listen to every Friday. We've done over 300 episodes in the 6 years since The Verge has been around, but you only need to listen to one, the latest one, to get caught up on everything in tech news. Vergecast is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere else you listen to podcasts. Check it out.